This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. State Senator Lonnie Randolph of East Chicago is with his colleagues in Indianapolis with the General Assembly for the 2020 session that started yesterday. But I had a chance to talk with him. I went to his law office in East Chicago on Thursday, asking more about the short session that's underway now, what he's bringing to the table as far as measures this session. And one of them is a bill that is dealing with school water safety issues.
Senator Randolph, tell us first about the measure that you and your colleague in Southlake County, Senator Rick Niemeyer, have sponsored up for the session that gets underway, dealing with the safety of water that youngsters and teachers and others in schools in Lake County will be able to benefit from if the bill makes it into law.
The issue was brought to my attention by the residents within the city of East Chicago and by recognizing that the same issue was developing in Hammond, or had existed in Hammond, but no one really brought it up. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, a lot of residents didn't realize how bad the soil contamination was, particularly in the Cadman area. And so then when the group started formulating, people started saying that, A, the remedy that the EPA is doing in terms of testing is not really curing because that stuff floats in the air. Then people said, well, what about the drinking water? Then all of a sudden the water was tested at a couple of grade schools. Turns out it had lead in it. Then they start complaining, well, what are you going to do about the testing of the lead in the water and everything? And then in the Hammond-Robbinsdale area, there's a couple testing. I think it was one homeowner discovered that there was soil contamination in their home they had just bought. Mm-hmm. And then there was testing in a water of a school there, tested positive for lead. So that's when I had a meeting with the, this is with the, the Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. There's a social group, that social political group in Hammond-Robbinsdale area called the Theodore Roosevelt Group, mm-hmm. okay? And I'm a member of that. And I went to the meeting, and it came up. And then when it came up, we started discussing it. And I said, well, that's the same issue they have in East Chicago. And they said, well, we're having the problem in Hammond. We need to do the testing. Turns out there's no regular testing of the water and everything. So that's when the idea of a bill came up. And that following legislative session, that's when, which was last year, that's when I filed the bill dealing with Hammond and East Chicago, because those were the two issues that was immediately available to me concerning that being a problem. And then we got it out of the Senate, because the biggest issue in the Senate was the cost factor, because I was looking at the entire state, well, let's strictly focus on East Chicago and Hammond, because at that point, maybe the other legislators would be supportive of it, because that it's not a big expense concerning their respective districts. So we got it out of the Senate. But when it got to the House, that's when the objections started coming in concerning the cost factor. And then I pointed out that the cost factor, I think the physical, we did a physical analysis on it, was only about, here's the bill. I should have had this out for you when you came. the estimated cost was about $1,600 a building, which wasn't very much. And by the time we're going back and forth bickering, the time period had elapsed, okay, before the committee can consider the bill. I guess each chairman has a certain cutoff date when they're going to consider new bills.
Right.
And the cutoff date was gone. So subsequent to that, I did have a meeting, not a meeting, but a conversation with the chairman of the committee. And there was another article came out about a school testing, and I sent that to him, and he sent a follow-up response indicating that he's considered hearing it this session. And then I talked with Senator Niemeyer, and Senator Niemeyer is saying that, hey, we've got the same issue in some schools in South County. So that's when he and I got together, decided that we'll focus on the entire county. And I told Senator Niemeyer that one of the biggest complaints were the cost factor, and I told him there was a very little cost factor. My original bill said an annual testing. So we've changed this to show every other session. In other words, budgetary year. So every 2 years they test. So that's where we are right now. And I'm glad that Senator Niemeyer is supportive of me concerning this issue. And he recognized that we're looking at not a partisan issue, a political issue. We're looking at an issue that affects every kid that goes to school in County of Lake.
So basically, you have it set up, the language in the bill will include not only the public schools, the private schools, and the charter schools, all of the schools, basically, in Lake County.
The private schools, yeah, the Catholic schools, charter schools, the visual schools, whatever school you got. It should include all of them. But the visual schools, I think, you know, and in homeschooling, that's an issue too. But either way, at some point, the homeschoolers, from time to time, is going to have to make a physical presence in a public school or a charter school, if in fact they've got something going on.
Right.
With them.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Is it just mainly the concern because of the situation that of which Lake County seems to be very unique, is the contamination problem because of the industrial nature of Lake County over the decades?
Yeah, that was original thinking, and that's what we had thought and we had assumed as well. But then I discovered, subsequent to the bill, there was a couple schools downstate outside of Marion County who had tested their water for lead. Turns out positive there as well. So I think the problem exists in other educational districts as well, but it has not been brought to the forefront. And maybe this bill might bring it to the forefront, is if it does, because we would like to see the bill go statewide. But if we can't, then at least let us get a start on it and everything.
Okay.
But now we think that we might get some supporters from, particularly from the Marion County area, whose district did some testing for some schools that tested positive for lead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, because obviously you have to get support not only from your fellow senators, but from the Indiana House of Representatives as well, too. First off, do you have any lawmakers over in the House that are they're going to help you out on the measure when it comes up over there eventually? And if so, would you think that this statewide interest might make it easier?
Yeah. Well, if in fact we get the legislators who have addressed me concerning the issue that they've got in Marion County, if in fact they're serious, and to the degree of the seriousness of the problem in their respective district, that'll dictate to me what kind of support we'll get from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the support from them will go a long way toward them supporting us and voting for it for Lake County, in addition to maybe considering it beyond Lake County for the entire state. I don't know.
Okay. What other measures do you have in plans that you've already introduced to file bills on already that will be coming up in this 2020 session of the General Assembly?
Well, the legislation that I have
right.
and everything? Mm-hmm. Well, I've got the obvious one I've got. Well, not obvious, but I got a lot of them. Everything. We have a limit. This is a short session. So in the Senate, we're limited to 10 bills during a short session. And the House is limited to 5 bills on a short session. So I had about 15 bills. But one of the ones I've got is this bill. It's a bill to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. Right now, there has been a big issue for the last 2 or 3 years in reference to these traffic incidents where you got a traffic stop and you got a traffic offender and who stopped, and as a result of that in other jurisdictions, other states end up being killed or injured or lawsuits being filed because of violation of civil rights issues coming up with the police department and the public and everything. And so I said, well, why don't we have some kind of a standard in Indiana, because we got a couple of lawsuits pending here in the county because we had one out of Hammond where motorists got stopped and they thought they were mistreated at that point in time. And I've had a couple cases, too, where I had people who were driving vehicles that got stopped and they felt they were roughed up by the police department and everything concerning that. And so I had a bill that indicates how a law enforcement officer should conduct themselves during a traffic stop and how an individual traffic offender should conduct themselves if, in fact, they are stopped. And then when I filed the bill, then I discovered that the Bureau of Motor Vehicles had started implementing a policy they added to their brochure that they got to come out that has some standards. Okay, and I was happy with that because they brought it to my attention that they were going to start doing that with my bill and everything. And so I was happy with that. My bill did not get heard at the last session. So this session, I expected to get heard so we can make that law.
Mm-hmm.
So this way it would be a standard-wise standardized procedure and how the law enforcement people should conduct themselves during a traffic stop and how people who are traffic offenders should conduct themselves during a traffic stop.
I know this being the short session, some people have said maybe only 40 days or so, thereabouts, about at least a month, maybe over. What are some of the issues that you expect to see come up during this relatively short session?
Well, the obvious issue I expect to come up is a redistricting issue. You know, we have been pushing, by we, I mean the mostly the Democratic caucus and the Senate. I can speak for them. I can't speak for the House. I'm assuming the House had the same thing. There's been a redistricting issue concerning this entire country. And we feel that there should be an independent commission set up to do the redistricting as opposed to having the legislators do it, because right now, you know, traditionally, historically, the majority ones have been the ones that have been redoing, you know, drawing the maps and everything. In this case, Republicans over the last decades have drawn the maps because they had the majority. And they drew the map to their advantage 10 years ago, and as a result of that, they got a supermajority in the Senate and a supermajority in the House. And that leads to an unfair representation of the people within the state of Indiana. We don't think that they're being fairly represented because they're not in a position to have their views expressed because of the minority interests of the Democrats, who might be Democrats throughout the state anyway. So we're looking for that in terms of an independent commission to be established for that, as opposed to having the legislators draw the maps. So that's one issue we're looking at. We're also looking at raises. We think that there's more than enough money in the budget to cover raises for teachers. Why didn't we did not give direct raises to the teachers in the last session? I do not know. They've recognized that we have a problem with the teachers. We got a teacher shortage. And they're saying we can't figure out why. Well, the reason why is because we have not been respecting teachers the way they should be respected because of the profession. I mean, we brought in these charter schools. We brought in vouchers. We did the budget. And an example of that is a budget. In the budget, we gave these big raises, supposedly the largest raises in the history of education for teachers, right? But majority of the additional, it weren't raises, but the majority of the additional money for education went toward retirement of the pension and with the charter schools and with the private schools. The public schools got about 2 or 3% of the total increase. The private schools, the charter schools got the largest percentage increase. So who are we kidding? So how are we going to respect the teacher's profession by looking at the public schools, which the Constitution says we had to support, by giving these charters and private schools more money than the public schools, okay? And there's a problem with that. I've got a bill that's pending now that I filed, too, where if, in fact, you're a school teacher, my wife was a school teacher, then eventually she was a principal, and a lot of times she came out of her own pocket to pay for things, supplies that she needed for the kids, where in Indiana, we have a $100 cap on the amount of money that you can write off your taxes for that. Well, I've got a bill increasing that to $500 because inflation by itself is increasing the cost of different supplies like pencils, notebooks, whatever the kids need. So, you know, those are concerns that we have right now that really pops in my mind concerning what we're focusing on as it's come time.
This, unfortunately, being a very, very political year, mostly on the federal level, but on the state level, too, do you see where that's going to maybe cause any kind of issues or at least would come up at any times as far as the General Assembly is concerned?
Well, I'm hoping that our congressional people, we've got 9 congressional people in the state of Indiana, of which only I think one is a Democrat, Al Moskowski, and the other one Republicans. But see, this is an issue that affects school kids and families. So you've got school kids and families, kids who come from Republican families as well. We've got Republicans who are professionals as well. We've got Republicans who are teachers as well. So this should be a people's issue, not a political issue at all. And I'm hopeful that, and I think the same issue exists with other states as well, because we hear about these different strikes that's going on, especially in Illinois and Michigan and all over. And so maybe the federal government will take a look at this issue as well and start looking at, hey, we got to respect teachers a little bit more. To give an example, and my wife was sent, the Rotary Club sent her on an educational tour to South Korea and to Japan, and she headed about a half a dozen other professionals to study their educational system. And when she got to South Korea and Japan, she discovered that the most revered profession in South Korea and Japan is education. If you are an educator, teacher in South Korea or Japan, you're higher than an executive, the CEO of a major corporation. That's how they look upon you with esteem there and everything. And it's such a revered profession in South Korea and Japan is that they have a higher suicide rate, very high suicide rate of kids, student kids who commit suicide because they feel if they don't do well in education in the school, they dishonor their family. Mm-hmm. As a result, some of them commit suicide.
Right.
So that's an issue that brought about that as well. But I'm just saying we have to start looking back on our teachers as professions of high esteem, which we're not. And as a result of that, you got a lot of kids that's going to school to college right now. They're not looking at it as a teacher, as education, as a professional field to go into after they graduate. We've got to reverse that.
Do you think that with this session coming up that's underway now, that the work will be there, the funds will be there to do what you want done this time around for education that haven't been able to been done last year or years before?
Well, the funds are there right now.
Yeah.
You know, we have a 2.1, last year we ended up with a $2.1 billion surpluses, right? That's there. That's in reserve. That's in case of emergency, right? Then as a result of that, because of some reversions that occur from different agencies, they came up, there's another $300 to $400 million that's available on top of the $2.1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So we got more than enough money to deal with teachers' wages, raises and everything. And the thing is, when we say, well, it's up to the educational district to go in and give the raises because we don't want to interfere with that. What do you mean you don't want to interfere? We interfere with everything else. The point is, most of these districts, especially the poor districts who don't have the funds, are difficult with raising funds through a referendum to operate on.
Right.
As a result of that, when they get some extra money, they need the extra money to maintain themselves, let alone give teachers raises, which is why we should take a direct action in terms of giving raises directly as opposed to doing it indirectly through the retirement system in terms of giving money for that, saying, well, they don't have to spend $175 million for retirement so they can use that for raises. No, that's not going to happen. That's not practical at all, especially when you got a smaller district or a poor district who needs funds just to maintain themselves.
Well, Senator Randolph, it looks like it's going to be a very interesting session that's underway, and we thank you for spending time with us to talk about the measures that you have in the hopper that they'll be considered up this session, and let's hope that it's a successful session all around.
Thank you. I thank you for giving me an opportunity just to voice my thoughts in terms of how things I expect to go. And I'm positive. I'm pretty excited about the session. I'm curious in terms of how it's going to go, and I'm thinking positive that I think it's going to go well. Well for the people and the Hoosiers and the residents of the state of Indiana.
State Senator Lonnie Randolph.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana. I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today we will be talking about the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment, which is an organization that addresses the issue of low minority participation in the union building trades. My guest today is Roman Bronson. Roman is a union journeyman electrician. He is currently the Northwest Indiana coordinator of the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. Roman, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your organization, the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment, and what is your role as area coordinator?
Okay, yeah. The Indiana Plan is a longstanding community outreach program. We've partnered with the building trades as well as contract association groups to reach out to underrepresented populations within the building trades. So that's minorities, women, veterans, groups of that nature. I'm the Northwest Indiana Area Director. It's a statewide organization, and our main office is in Indianapolis.
Can you briefly talk about how you get people involved in your application process? You know, how does somebody go apply to get into your program and get involved in your community outreach program?
We have an online application. That's primarily the way that we collect applicants. You do have the option of coming in and applying paper, but it just works better as far as applying online. As far as what you need to apply, just a valid driver's license. You need a high school diploma equivalent, and also you got to know that we do drug testing. So we work with the Building Construction Resource Center that handles all of our drug testing, and those are the main requirements as far as getting involved with the program.
What is the web address where people can go to apply?
It's indianaplan.org, I-N-D-I-A-N-A, plan.org.
And I take it they could access the application from the front page of that website?
Yep, it's right there in the front descriptions. You'll see a highlighted text.
for an applicant that actually goes through the application process, they pass the admission test, they pass the drug screening. What is the next step for that applicant? I mean, what can they expect while going into the program?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So if you are selected for the Indiana plan, we have limited spots available. We have quarterly classes, and we usually do around 10 people per class. But if you are involved with our program, what you can expect is further understanding of apprenticeships as far as how to apply, what to expect during an apprenticeship. We also have presentations from different union officials to give you an in-depth understanding of what that industry is all about and how to be successful in it. We also get you some safety credentials so you can start building your resume. And we also work with certain contractors to get you some on-the-job training so, again, you can start building your resume and become a better applicant for an apprenticeship.
Do you ever take the applicants and go visit a construction job site to give them firsthand knowledge of what goes on a job site, or do you take them to any of the various apprenticeship training centers here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, we do site tours of different apprenticeships. It's 21 different apprenticeships represented around Northwest Indiana, and we try to get a percentage of that as far as going to their facilities and getting presentations by their apprenticeship coordinators. We are also working on visiting different construction sites. Those are a little bit more spotty because there's some safety things that you got to take into account before you can go on a construction site. A lot of hazards there. But definitely all those things that helps inform an individual as far as what the industry is all about and how they can get involved.
So you're an electrician by trade. You were trained in local, was it 697?
Yeah, 697, yes, sir.
So you have kind of direct knowledge of what it takes to succeed in the industry as a union tradesman. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what it takes to get into a career in the construction trades and what kind of individuals tend to succeed?
It may sound a little corny, but some of the main attributes you got to have is you got to be enthusiastic about the your career choice. I would say working through an apprenticeship, as far as applying, is usually it takes time to get through that application process. So I would definitely say patience. That enthusiasm helps get you through that whole process and have a good attitude about it. Also working hard. I mean, you got to have that work ethic. Something as well as you got to like to be outside. You're going to be working outside, whether it's hot, cold, it's, you know, all these different weather conditions. You got to be able to enjoy that. You got to be willing to step up to challenges. I mean, getting through an apprenticeship, being on those job sites, it's tight deadlines, it's high quality expectations, and you got to be able to meet all that and not just meet it but exceed it. One of the more important attributes is being on time. Punctuality is one of the main criteria that they're looking for. You got to be there every day and on time. Also remaining drug-free. You got to realize that certain things aren't worth your career. So those are some of the major points as far as what's going to make a good tradesperson.
That's a lot of great information about the Indiana plan, Roman. Unfortunately, we are out of time today, but we're going to pick up this conversation next week. Well, that'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. Thanks again to our guest, Roman Bronson, with the Northwest Indiana Director of the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. For more information on the Indiana Plan, please visit their website at www.indianaplan.org. And for more information about all the trades, you can visit www.webuildnwi.com.
And you can hear part two of this conversation next week. Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation, and it's heard every Tuesday on Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, and the podcasts are found at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Good neighbors, that's an oxymoron, isn't it? I think it is. All the counties in Northwest Indiana, especially Lake and Porter counties, live in this tribal fiefdom of parochial little communities. And we say that we are a melting pot, and I never thought we're a melting pot. And some people try to gloss that up by saying, well, we live in a salad. And, you know, we're not mixing like soup, but at least we're coexisting like a crouton and a piece of lettuce. And I just dispel that, too. We don't even do that. You know, we can't even be a salad in this region. Because if you think of stereotypes, Porter County is like bumpkins, and Lake County is thugs. And that's how we still quantify things pretty much to this day, although it's going back decades with that characterization. And Porter County makes fun of Lake County, which is humorous because Lake County makes fun of Porter County, of course. And they think that thugs only exist in Lake County until the Portage mayor got indicted for possible corruption charges. And he's a Republican. So, whoa, wait, you're shaking things up in the region. You can't have a Republican from Porter County being indicted. Just Democrats from Lake County should be indicted. So, yeah, I still think we want to exist, but we can't. And that's why we have so many communities. We don't have a hub. Gary is not, it's supposed to be the hub, and it's not really anymore because it's Gary. So we lost our hub. We lost our identity. So we have all these little cooks in the kitchen who think they are the chef, and they're just sous chefs or whatever the word would be. Yeah, so things should change. We should get along better. We should play nicer in the sandbox of Northwest Indiana and the dunes together, and we don't do that well enough. And it's usually by greed and fear and prejudice, those components of human nature that we can't really control as well as we'd like to think we can. So it can definitely get better. I just don't think it will, to be honest. And I have no prescription for it. I mean, I don't prescribe things. You know, I'm not that. People think that because of my job sometimes, because I write and, you know, and people read my stuff and then, well, you should prescribe this. But I'm not a preacher. I don't prescribe things. I just reflect, I think, what we have. What I really want to do most with my jobs is just show a nice, honest, fair mirror that I just Windexed off. That's nice and clear. This is who we are. That's it. You do what you want with it. I don't care. Don't give me this disillusioned, glossy effect of who we are. This is who we really are. So this is what Northwest Indiana is, and I'm fine with it. Yeah, I'm really fine with it.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking. Two longtime environmental groups have merged and drafted plans for a refocused mission on children's environmental and health initiatives. The Hoosier Environmental Council took in Improving Kids' Environment, and both nonprofits are now under the HEC banner. When the announcement was made, Jesse Carbonda and Dr. Indira Frank were on Regionally Speaking to talk about the combined effort to help Hoosier young people.
Improving Kids' Environment was founded 20 years ago, and its aim was to figure out how to reduce risks, toxic risks to kids, whether it was in the context of homes, schools, or the community at large. And from my vantage point, one of the benefits of bringing these two organizations together is that it increases our legislative capacity to help improve children's health. Mm-hmm. In particular, one of the things that I've come to learn is that this merger will lead to about a 25% increase in our email contact base, and that allows us to have even greater capacity to try to galvanize the public to address a number of pieces of legislation that have bearing on children's health.
I would imagine that also gives you the opportunity with the base to be expanded to include not only health professionals, but educators and families as well, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And those are constituencies that while we have relationships with over our 36-year history, this no doubt enhances it, given that Ike held conferences year after year, which brought in folks who are running schools, who are running daycare centers, public health professionals, and so forth. So those are constituencies that may or may not have been aware of legislation that has bearing on children's health, like funding for IDEM, like funding for the Indiana State Department of Health and county health departments, which certainly the more funding we have, that means we have more inspectors, that means we have the ability to retain quality permit riders, and ultimately those things benefit public health. So from my vantage point, and I know that Indra will speak to the very specific initiatives that we'll be taking on, proactive initiatives, but I really want to emphasize the importance of it expanding our legislative capacity.
Before we look at the initiatives here, Dr. Frank, tell us if you've had an opportunity with your tenure with the HEC as the Environmental Health Director, if you had some contact to improving children's environments, and what kind of work that you've been able to do either alongside them or with them, I guess, in many respects.
Well, good question, Chris. I'm a physician specialized in environmental health, and in the 15 years that I've been practicing environmental health, I've spent a good portion of that with Improving Kids' Environment. I served on their board of directors for a total of 9 years before I even became affiliated with the Hoosier Environmental Council. I've come to the conclusion that, you know, every environmental problem has human health consequences. And our children are often the most vulnerable when it comes to environmental problems impacting their health. Pound for pound, children breathe more air, drink more water, and eat more food than adults do. And so if there are harmful exposures in those media, they wind up with a disproportionate amount. And then they're also more susceptible because their bodies are still growing and developing, and those developing systems may not be mature enough to handle a harmful exposure.
Will you tell us about the different children's health initiatives that the Hoosier Environmental Council, now with improving kids' environment in this merger, will be able to accomplish, or maybe some new initiatives that you'd like to establish?
Oh, absolutely. So all of the work that Hoosier Environmental Council has been doing benefits the children of Indiana, but this gives us an opportunity to really intentionally focus on the things that are particularly harmful to children. We have three initiatives that we're launching with this merger. One is to provide an information resource on children's environmental health. Improving Kids Environment built a very helpful website that serves families and educators and healthcare professionals on children's environmental health issues. We're going to maintain and build on that website so that there's a really good information hub. And then second, we're going to continue Ike's work to reduce lead poisonings in Indiana. More than 1,000 children each year have elevated blood lead levels in Indiana, and that could put both their intelligence and potentially behavior problems at risk. And then third, we're working to ensure that Indiana's children have clean water to drink and clean streams and lakes to play in. And there are multiple initiatives at Hoosier Environmental Council that are working both, you know, during the legislative session, but also with programming in the communities to reduce impacts to our waterways, especially of E. coli. So E. coli is a bacterium that comes from feces, and unfortunately, it is the top pollutant in Indiana's waterways. We have several different initiatives to help Indiana move forward with reducing that pollutant.
Discussions began in July 2018, and as any responsible organization would do, we wanted to think through this from the standpoint of finances, that this was a sound decision for HEC. We wanted to think about this in terms of strategy. Would we be able to absorb the, elements of the programming of Ike? Would we be able to enhance the relationships, or could it be potentially detrimental to bring these groups together?
Yeah.
So once that due diligence was done, we proceeded ahead. I think that the great benefit that I see is that, number one, that as Indra mentioned, there will be a web portal that we'll be inheriting, which is very well regarded in the public health and educator community, given all the work that Ike did to help to mitigate risks from things like pesticides and lead. And so that's a portal that we will continue building upon, and that will be a very important resource going forward for those educators and health professionals. And then the second thing is, once again, just the breadth of context that we'll be able to bring on board and engage, particularly from a public policy perspective, because I think a lot of these folks, educators and health professionals, will probably be getting engaged principally from a programming lens. And I think now my hope is that we can engage them on a legislative lens.
That is Jesse Carbonda, along with Dr. Indira Frank with the Hoosier Environmental Council. Hoosier lawmakers say they'll push forward with legislation to increase the legal age to buy tobacco from 18 to 21. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports it's despite what Congress has already done to change the federal law.
Raising the legal age to smoke and vape to 21 is on the agenda of both House and Senate Republicans this year, and Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says that's despite federal lawmakers already changing the law nationwide.
Well, I mean, on the outside chance they decide to change that, we would still have that in place.
House Speaker Brian Bosman notes the federal change still leaves enforcement to the states.
So the enforcement of those who choose to sell to minors, to under 21 actually, is a focus in the bill.
Bosma says passing the bill at the state level will also help with retail education of the change. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Lawmakers and activists gathered at the State House to support redistricting reform ahead of the new maps that are coming out in 2021. And Lauren Chapman reports that the bipartisan group had promoted two bills for greater transparency in redistricting.
Next year, Indiana's Constitution requires legislators to redraw maps for state and federal voting districts based on population data from the U.S. Census. Republican State Senator John Rogelshaus has authored legislation to promote greater transparency in that process. One bill he's offered for the last 3 years would create a redistricting commission. The second bill would create an educational tool to teach citizens about the process and allow them to draw their own maps.
We've entered an era now that people want transparency. The ultimate goal here is to draw as competitive maps as possible. Competition is a good thing.
Ruckelhaus says these bills have both Republican and Democratic support in both the House and Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
The fellow who is best known for C-SPAN, Brian Lamb, has stepped aside the TV camera, the microphone, at least on a full-time basis now. He's still on occasionally, but he's stepped away from this full-time job that he had. That goes all the way back to the creation of C-SPAN many years ago. And we have Brian Lamb with us on the phone from the C-SPAN headquarters to talk about it. Brian, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. If you will, first tell us a little bit about how your involvement in broadcasting and what you did in Washington, D.C. led up to the creation of C-SPAN.
Well, I came here in the United States Navy back in 1966, and born and raised in Lafayette, went to Purdue, spent 4 years in the Navy, and I got started in all this by seeing what was going on inside the Pentagon. And I was not an important part of the Pentagon. I was a gopher, but I was a lieutenant junior grade, and that's how I got started in this town.
And what made you think that that C-SPAN would be something important? I know you've had a lot of support over the years, I guess, taking your idea of getting public affairs on television, and in particular on cable TV, because I know that's how you created C-SPAN, is by your cooperation with all of the cable systems around the country.
I actually didn't think it was going to be necessarily important. I thought it was going to be an interesting possibility to be an alternative for everything else that was on television news. There was no real public affairs. Public television dabbled in it, but on a national basis, they found that in order to keep the money coming in, they had to get away from a lot of that. They weren't anxious to do a lot of hearings. When I started with it, we had no idea where it would go, and it all started because technology changed. The satellite was launched back in 1975 for cable, and they started, HBO was the first one, they started using the satellite, and it just seemed like something that I could suggest to the industry, didn't have any idea if they'd take it, and they, you know, it wasn't going to cost much, and a couple of really good guys thought that it would be a good civics opportunity, and that's how it started.
How difficult was it to get the chance to see sessions of Congress, either the House and the Senate or both of them, on television, and now to see them basically full-time?
The House had been talking about it for years, but nobody knew it, and they had a little commission set up behind the scenes. And when I first pitched the idea of something to the cable television industry, it wasn't to cover the House gavel to gavel. They first said, a couple guys said, yeah, we can fund that. That makes sense, and it wasn't going to cost much. But after they went around and talked to people in the cable industry, they started saying, I don't think that's worth it. I don't see where there's a market for that. And, of course, we never intended it to be a for-profit thing. Then all of a sudden, after they said no the first time around, actually a lot of people said no, The House decided to go on television, and I was right in the mix at that point and found out about it before they made the final decision and made the suggestion that maybe if they decided to put the House on television that the cable people could carry it to the home, and that's how it started. It all just went very fast back in 1977 in October. When it was voted in.
Now, how long did it take to get the Senate on cable as well, too?
They were so dead set against the idea, and the old-timers didn't want anything to do with transparency and opening it up. It took till June 2nd of 1986 to go on television.
Wow, more than a decade later, then, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. What, were they just afraid that they didn't want to see people with their shirt tails out or chewing gum or something or smoking on camera?
I don't really know. I think it's a case of where people like the power they have in these institutions, and bringing something in from the outside called television made them nervous. It's the same thing going on right now with the Supreme Court. They're dead set against the idea of going on television, and it'll be a while. And they don't have the same concerns that members of the House and Senate have, which is basically getting voters to vote for them. So it's an interesting thing to watch the whole idea of opening the process up. There are a lot of people that talk about it, but very few people in positions of power that really want to do it.
Now, being with the C-SPAN concept from the very beginning, and of course going first with members of the House and then the Senate, of course, and other activities of government in Washington, D.C., you started doing conversations about books, talking to authors and the like. What are some of the things that you remember the most? That, in fact, it's only been just a few years ago that you had quit doing the book reviews and the like here. What do you remember most about talking with the authors?
Well, I started in 1988 with an interview with a guy named Neil Sheehan, who wrote a book, The Bright Shining Lie, which was all about Vietnam, and it was very much anticipated. It took him 16 years to write it. I just got intrigued by the idea after Vietnam, which was such a miserable experience for this country, that Neil Sheehan might be able to shed some really interesting light on why we got in there and what happened. And so I sat down with him for 2.5 hours. We created 5 programs, stripped them across the 8 o'clock hour. And after that, it seemed like what a great, interesting possibility to talk to authors about their hardback nonfiction books. That's what started Book Notes in 1989. I did it for 16 years and decided that, and I had my own rules, that I had to read the book and it had to be a hardback and it had to be nonfiction and it could only be an author on the show once. And I got to the end of 16 years and said, "I this is taking too much of my time." So I just changed the name, called it Q&A, kept doing it until right now, and still did a lot of books. So I just stumbled into the whole thing about books, and it's been very important to us.
Now let's go from Book Notes to your book that you have out there available that you've written not long ago and is available to look at here about the presidents. Give us an idea first about how you came up with the concept and a little bit about the book.
Actually, when we started Book Notes, we came up with the concept of doing a book very long time ago, over 20 years ago, by taking the author's comments and their narrative and taking my questions out and creating 10-page chapters that reflect what they said in the interviews. And we've done 9 of those books, and this latest book is called The Presidents, and it's 44 chapters, 44 different presidencies. It does not have a chapter. It has a chapter on Donald Trump, but not about whether he was successful or not. It just talks about what the atmospherics were when he got elected. And the idea was to be able to read about something about each president, and then when you're interested, dig deeper on your own. Go get the book, go get other books, and just give yourself a good civics education.
I guess you could say, I guess, about Donald Trump that in a word that the story about him hasn't yet been written. So I guess you can't put that chapter in anyway, could you?
Not even close to being written. And we don't do these surveys of where the presidents stand until after they're out of office.
We're talking with Brian Lamb, who is a native of Lafayette, a graduate of Purdue University, and is the creator of the concept, and later now what we know as C-SPAN, the cable television networks, more than one network, we should say, that deals with public affairs and a lot of it dealing with official Washington, D.C. And we should say, too, that C-SPAN has an outreach to Indiana still, don't they? They have an operation based in northwest Indiana that kind of helps service C-SPAN in a way, doesn't it?
We have our video archive with 250,000 hours of hearings and everything we've had on the network since 1987, located in West Lafayette, Indiana. It was originally associated with Purdue, but we separated some years ago, and we just kept it in Lafayette, run by a Purdue professor who works for us on a full-time basis, Robert Browning. And anybody in the country, anybody in the world that can access the archive on the Internet can watch any program we've done over those last 250,000 hours.
Oh, my gosh. 250,000 hours. Hard to believe, to be sure.
I know.
Now, keeping you in Northwest Indiana, in Lafayette in particular, how did growing up in Lafayette and your experiences in Lafayette and West Lafayette there at Purdue seem to shape your life and, in turn, your career?
Had tremendous impact. I went to Purdue. I was a hometown guy. My father was from that area. My mother came out of Arkansas. Lafayette was a very open community. They were very interested in people like me getting to do anything they wanted to do and take a chance. And my first boss at WASK, which you worked at for some years, was Henry Rosenthal.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry was a mentor. And I also worked at the local television station. Fella from Indiana, Dick Shively, was the owner there. And these were very important people to me, including my high school broadcasting teacher. It all came out of that community to give me the chance to do what I've done, which, you know, trust me, I'm very grateful.
Give us some recollections, if you will, about starting out in local broadcasting. We always think of the big city, like in our case, Chicago, or New York, or Los Angeles, or other bigger cities, or smaller cities of that magnitude. What's it like to work in local radio, and what did you happen to remember and kind of bring back some anecdotes about it?
Well, what I've learned since I was in local radio is that national radio is no different. If you're doing what comes naturally, you're trying to pass information on to the public, and it really doesn't feel any different. When I was in Lafayette on that radio station, one day a buddy of mine and I called a guy named Franklin McCormick. He used to do an all-night show on WGN in Chicago. And I remember my question to him was, how does somebody like me, and I think I was 19 at the time, get from Lafayette to having a big-time job like you in Chicago?
Yeah.
And he said, well, if my recommendation is you stay there as long as you can, because what you're learning there is just as significant as what you're going to learn beyond there, and then come to the big city and give that a try later. Lafayette Radio allowed me to interview all kinds of well-known national figures because Purdue would have these entertainers come to campus. One of the first ones I ever interviewed was a man named Nat King Cole, and he was a tremendous personality in those days, and he would entertain at Purdue. He died at age 45. But when he was there, he allowed me to interview him for the local radio station. The Kingston Trio were really a big deal. They came to that area, and I went up to Monticello, Indiana, and sat down and interviewed them. And what I most remember from that interview is that I said after it was over, it was only 15 minutes, I said, let me check the tape. I checked the tape, and it didn't take.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at these three guys, and I said, is there any way we can do this again? Because if I go back to Lafayette without an interview with you, I'm going to get fired. And those guys, Nick Reynolds, Bob Shane, and David Gard, said yes. So I redid the interview, and I went back, and I wasn't a hero, but I certainly wasn't dismissed from the radio station.
Well, at least you got the interview. That's right. It happens like that. Well, those problems happen even today, even in the digital age. And that brings me to my final question to you, Brian, to talk about your views about the changing media landscape, especially here in the internet era.
I love what's happening. I know there's some glitches. I know there's some concern, but people have never had this kind of freedom in the history of the world. And it's so much fun to watch people create their own podcasts. I just saw a headline somewhere, is Bill Clinton going to create his own podcast? Wouldn't surprise me. It's a lot of fun. It doesn't cost much. Nobody controls what you're going to say. If it doesn't work, so what? And there's never been this opportunity like there is now. And I love what's going on. I don't like some of the nasty stuff that we hear, but we started out hearing the nasties when we started our call-in show in October of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
People, when they're anonymous, can say whatever they want to say, and it creates somewhat of this hate atmosphere we have. But I think we've got to have faith that over time this is all going to settle down, and the freedom that people have is extraordinary.
Do you think that maybe with this being the podcast era, that because anybody can do a podcast, you can also say, too, that if you do it right, do it slickly enough, I suppose, for some, that you can make lots of money from it, I suppose?
I guess. It's never been the kind of thing that drove me to make money. And this is a nonprofit company supported by the cable television business, or we wouldn't be here. But yes, I hear people talking all the time about doing it for money and doing it with advertisers. And it obviously, in several cases, it works.
Now, Brian, let me ask just a little question now. That is the last question. If you could do something all over again, what would you do?
Well, it's pretty simple. If I had this to do over again, I would raise more money in the beginning. It caused us to struggle during the early part of the cable business programming getting bigger and bigger. And because of that, we haven't been treated in some cases as well as we could have been if we were in a little bit better financial condition. Having said that, we're in great financial condition during this period right now, and we're going to need it because cable television is losing subscribers to the young kids that aren't interested in they want their their smartphones, and that's what they're number one interested in. And so it's going to give us a cushion, but that's what I would do differently if I could start over again, but I'm not going to be able to.
Well, Brian Lamb, thank you for spending time with us today. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with not only, a giant of the telecommunications industry and how you've created C-SPAN and how it's become the great public affairs networks of today, but also, too, that you're an Indiana native and that you've been able to show folks back here in Indiana that you can take a simple idea and turn it into something very successful. Thank you for being with us today, Brian.
Thanks, Chris. I always consider myself a Hoosier, no matter how far I get away from it, and it was a great place to grow up.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.